If you would take your Bibles tonight and turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12 will be where we'll be studying tonight. At least that's where we'll start. Sure is good to see all of you here tonight. It's been a good week here. I appreciate it so very much, the invitation to come. Thanks to the shepherds here for inviting me. I've enjoyed my time with you and the studies that we have had here in the building and the meals that I've had in your homes and also out in restaurants. It's just been outstanding. The way you've provided for me has just been wonderful. It's been great to meet the quarters. Although I knew of them, this is the first time I've really gotten to spend time with them, and they just have a great family, and I know that they're doing good work here, and I appreciate so much what they do here and also the work that Tad does abroad. But for all of you who have come this week, some of you have been here every time. Some of you visiting have been here several times, and that just means so very much. Good to see Jake and Taylor tonight. They're from Danville Road, and I'm loving my work there and getting to know them. I appreciate them coming over tonight and supporting this work. Again, for everything you've done that just made this a wonderful week for me and my wife and my dad, Jonathan Stanford, with me tonight from the Oakland congregation. I appreciate everything that's been done. Good to see you. I don't think I'll ever forget Little League Baseball. It was just big to me when I was young. It was awesome. I just felt so big, and the uniforms were wonderful to wear, and you just felt like that everything was just a major thing. I still have my first home run ball. It was a grand slam. And as soon as I hit it, I just knew that I was headed for the major leagues. But I think the most exciting thing about it was all the people in the stands who would cheer for you and root you on and wanted you to win. It just filled you with adrenaline. But to be able to look over and to see my daddy or my mama or my grandmama and granddaddy, again, just pumped adrenaline through me. People in the stands can make a big difference. In fact, they sometimes refer to the home crowd as the thing that gives an athlete a huge advantage. They call it the home field advantage or the home crowd advantage. And when you come to Hebrews chapter 12, I believe that's what we have here in Hebrews chapter 12. We've come to an athletic event. In this case, I believe that it's a race that's being referred to. And it's a race that all Christians are running as they run toward the finish line. Let's read together in chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For I consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. And so here we have a race, and all of us are running in this Christian race. But the picture here in Hebrews chapter 12 is that as we run up there in the grandstands is a whole host of people who have finished their race. And they are now encouraging us to run on, to finish well. They have done that, and they're now sitting down to encourage us. I believe they are the people of Hebrews chapter 11. We're familiar with all those people mentioned in chapter 11 who by faith did this or that in their allegiance to God. But now they are here and we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Let us run this race and let us run it with endurance. The text said that these people do two things for us. They encourage us, first of all, to lay aside every weight. Anything that holds you back from running well, you have to get rid of. In fact, those who run races, they don't want any extra weight. They're trying to eliminate as much weight as they can. You know, some things are not sinful in and of themselves, but when they weigh us down, they become sinful because of that very thing. So he says, you lay aside every weight. But then he says, you lay aside the sin that so easily ensnares you. What would that be for you? You know, I think all of us have something probably that works on us more than anything else. And what that thing is for me and what that thing is for you might be totally different. But he's saying you lay aside that sin that so easily ensnares you. So here's the idea of putting aside whatever it takes to keep you from running this race and running it well. You know, sometimes it's easy to make excuses for not entering this race. We offer excuses as to why we can't run this race. But what I want us to see in the lesson tonight is that for every excuse that we may offer, there is somebody up there in the stands that's going to take that excuse away from you. No matter what you say, somebody there will take away that excuse. And we'll go through some of that tonight. Here's somebody who says, well, God, I just couldn't see any evidence that you really existed. I mean, come on. I mean, how can you expect me to see an invisible God? But hang on a minute. You know who I see over here? There's Moses. Up there in the stands is Moses, and he saw an invisible God. Turn to Hebrews chapter 11 and notice what it says in verse 24. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 24, speaking of Moses, it says, by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. And now catch verse 27. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who was invisible. What this text is saying is that Moses suffered so many things, and he pressed on with the people of God because he could see the invisible God. And let me tell you something, you can too. I've often said, if you can't see God, you need to go outside. I think people who say there is no God, maybe they've been shut behind a computer or something too long. Go outside and take yourself a good look. In fact, when I was in Gardendale, Alabama, we suffered one of the greatest tragedies that I've ever suffered as a gospel preacher and brother in Christ. In one single accident in Sweetwater, Tennessee, we lost 4 members of the Gardendale Church in that one accident. They were stopped in traffic in Sweetwater, Tennessee, and for some unexplained reason to this day, an 18-wheeler slammed into them from the rear, pushing them into another 18-wheeler that was loaded with steel. And over the course of one weekend, I preached 3 funerals. 4 church members lost all at once. One of those members was a teenager whose name was Justin Nash. Justin was an aspiring cartoonist. And after his death, his daddy took his cartoons and made a book of them and had various ones to write articles relating to what the young man had put down. On Justin Nash's tombstone is this scene that I have for you on the screen. It's got a young man lying on the back 40. His house is somewhere up on the horizon, but he's laying there on the back 40 and he's looking up at the sky. And it simply says, atheists must not get out much. And what Justin is saying in that is that when you get out and you really look and you ponder, you come to realize that all of this is done by an incredible, powerful, awesome God that Justin could see with the eye of faith. Really, what Justin is saying in this cartoon is the same thing that said in Romans chapter 1. Turn to Romans chapter 1 with me. In Romans chapter 1, Paul is laying his case against the Gentiles who are trying to press down the truth about God. But in verse 20, he says, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Yes, God himself might be invisible, but his invisible attributes are clearly seen by anybody who wants to see them. You look out and you realize that somebody with unimaginable intelligence put all of this together. You see power beyond anything that any man could do. You see design and you see creativity. All of these things are there and you can see it all. And what Paul says here is anybody on the day of judgment who tries to say to God, well, God, I just couldn't see any evidence that you existed. God would say, I'm not buying it. You are without excuse. My fingerprints were everywhere. I tell you what I think the problem is. Somebody once said, an atheist cannot find God for the same reason that a thief can't find a policeman. He doesn't want to. A policeman is the last thing he wants showing up. And I believe it's exactly that way with a lot of people. They have already reasoned through that if there is a God, then I'm accountable to Him. And if I'm accountable to Him, I have to make changes in my life. And I don't want to do that. No God. But there's Moses, who saw that invisible God and says, if I can serve that God, then you can serve that God too. You know, knowing that God exists is so very basic. Turn to Hebrews 11 and verse 3. I've always loved this verse. It's just so common sense. In Hebrews chapter 11, it says in verse 3, by faith we understand, Hebrews 11:3, by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. But if you'll turn back to Hebrews 3 now in verse 4, notice how in Hebrews chapter 3 in verse 4 it says this. It says every house is built by someone. isn't that just common sense? Every house is built by someone. You know, if you're walking through the woods and you come upon an old house, you don't say, well, I guess that thing just popped out of the ground. No, you understand that somebody built that house. Every house is built by someone. I see design, intelligence, creativity, all of that I see in this house. The verse goes on to say in verse 4, but he who built all things is God. The heavens shout the existence of God. In the Old Testament, perhaps one of the best places to see this is in Psalm 19, where the psalmist in Psalm 19, David says in verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech and night unto night reveals knowledge. And so the firmament shows the handiwork of God. But then verse 3, there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth and their words to the end of the world. I think what he's saying there is it doesn't matter what language you speak. Every man, no matter what language he speaks, can look up in the sky and it speaks in his language that I am in your world. The evidence for God is everywhere. And so if you ever question the existence of God, just remember who's up there in the stands. There's Moses, and he saw an invisible God. Moses understood that the most real things can't be seen anyway. I've often said Christians have great vision. We can see the unseen. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and notice that. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and in verse 17. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4:17, our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but rather at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things that are not seen are eternal. Now that tells us something important here, that not only are there invisible things, but it is the things that are not seen that are eternal. I've always said, if you can see it with your eyes, kiss it goodbye. I think about this building. One day this building's going to burn. One day your house is going to burn. One day the very elements of this earth are going to melt. There's only one thing I know of in this building that will last forever, and you can't see it. You know what it is? It's your soul. You have one. I've never seen it, but I know you have one. The things that are unseen are eternal. When I was in Troy, Alabama, we used to worship in Brundage, and there was a lady that we would take with us to worship. She was blind. She had been that way since she was just a little girl. All of a sudden, she just began to lose her sight. And so almost all her life, she had had no sight at all. Her name was Gussie. Every once in a while, she'd get a little cantankerous, and we'd call her Fussy Gussie. But I remember Miss Gussie on one of those trips to Brundage. She said to me, "Jeff," she said, "people say I can't see." She said, "but I can see a whole lot of things that other people can't." She was right. She was right. She could see God. She could see Jesus. She could see heaven. She could see the things that last and are made to be forever. In your songbooks, there's a lady who wrote a huge number of the songs in our songbook. Her name is Fanny Crosby. She was blind. But I want you to read the lyrics to her songs and then tell me that woman couldn't see. That woman could see. That woman had incredible vision. And what bothers me is that there are people who want to look at people like that and they want to try to say, "well, if that's what God is, I'll have no part of him. And I don't believe there's a God because look at all the people dealing with various problems and handicaps and those kind of things." And I'll tell you one thing I've always noticed. It generally is not the people who has those handicaps that are doing the complaining. It's other people looking at that. Other night I had Jamie Purcell with me. He has cerebral palsy. Been that way all his life. I asked Jamie on one occasion, I said, "Jamie, I said, if you could go back and do it all over again, would you choose not to be born with cerebral palsy?" He said, "I wouldn't change a thing." Jamie doesn't blame God. In fact, Jamie preaches one of the finest sermons I've ever heard. He calls it "Rise Up and Walk." In fact, when I'm getting Jamie out of the vehicle that he's all strapped in, Jonathan knows about it, he's done the same thing. When I get Jamie out of that vehicle, every time we have a ritual, I'll unstrap Jamie and I'll say, "loose him." And he'll say, "and let him go." He's thinking about John 11. And he understands that one day Jesus is going to say to his old body, "loose him and let him go." Jamie doesn't blame God. Jamie believes in this invisible God just like Moses did. You can't use that one with God. Here's somebody who says, "well, sexual temptation, it's just too strong. I cannot live the pure Christian life." And admittedly, oh yeah, it's strong. In fact, we won't go to these passages, I'll just refer to them, but in Jeremiah 5, verse 7 and 8, when God was trying to talk about just how full of adultery his people were, he said in Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 7 and 8, "you're like well-fed, lusty stallions who neigh after their neighbor's wife." Then he said in chapter 2 and verse 24 that Israel would sniff at the wind in her desire. That's the idea of an animal picking up the scent of what he desires to go after. And as we talk about sexual temptation and how strong it can be, I'm reminded of a man who told a story about a time he went deer hunting. He said he had been out there, it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, hadn't seen anything. And he was doing what deer hunters do. He said, this is a bust. And so he's already thinking through the afternoon, already planning the afternoon hunt in his mind because this has been a bust. All of a sudden he hears a crashing over in the thicket. And he looks out and he says, it was that kind of crashing sound that just sends an adrenaline rush into your body. And I look, and here is a buck chasing a doe. And they're running on a flat from right to left. They're only 40 yards away. He said, I lifted up my .30-06 and I said, boom, boom. He said, and looking at the craters in the ground, I'd hit the underside of Australia. He then said, I looked and realized I had missed everything. I thought to myself, I have just fired a major high-powered cannon at this guy. He has not stopped. He has not looked up. He has not even acknowledged my existence. He said I could have been playing a piano in the stand and he wouldn't have paid any attention. He said, about that time, he said, the same two deer came back. I heard the crashing again. This time they're running from left to right, and she's running him across the field. And he's thinking, he might not know, but evidently she does. And I think I heard her say, shoot him! Shoot him! And again, boom! Boom! And again, he's hit absolutely nothing. Normally a deer is granted by God with great wisdom. They have eyes that are incredible, but you can beat his eyes. They have ears that are turned like satellite dishes, but you can beat his ears. The thing that's hard to whip is his nose. But in the rut, all that's different. During the rut, he does crazy things. He doesn't care. He's not cautious. He throws all wisdom to the wind because he's thinking about one thing only. And that's okay. There's not much you can do to stop a white-tailed buck in those 4 or 5 weeks. But here's what I want to say. Men, we are not white-tailed bucks. And the sad thing is, and I want to say this, men, and I've seen women too, made in the image of God, capable of living on a high moral plane, throw away all of that wisdom. And with their minds focused on one thing and one thing only, they don't care what it will cost them. They don't care if it costs them their wife, if it costs me my husband, if it costs me my children, even if it costs me my life. And even if it costs me my soul. Turn to Proverbs chapter 7. In Proverbs chapter 7. Proverbs chapter 7, beginning in verse 21. It says, with her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver. As a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know that it would take his life. Now therefore, listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths, for she has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. You don't have to be a weak man to fall to this. Strong men have fallen to sexual temptation. Verse 27 says, her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. And so some may be tempted to say, as they think about this Christian race, sexual temptation is just too strong. But hang on a minute, you know who I see over here? There's Joseph. And if sexual temptation is present, Joseph would say, you can resist. You can run this race. You can win this race, even if you have to withstand fierce sexual temptation. Turn to Genesis 39. In Genesis 39, we have that story of Joseph. You remember how he ended up in Potiphar's household, having been sold by his brothers. But in Genesis 39, beginning in verse 6, it says concerning Potiphar that he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. And he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. He's a good-looking man. Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph and said, lie with me. Women can be guilty of lust too. But he refused her and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There's no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And so it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time, when Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house were inside, that she caught him by his garment and said, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and he fled and he ran outside. And she later accuses him of trying to rape her. And so here's somebody who says, well, sexual temptation was just too strong. Joseph would say, flee. I mean, he literally had to run out of his coat. If you have to flee, if you have to literally run to get away from it, do it. So Joseph would say, you run with everything that you've got. But I think another thing that Joseph would say to the married man is, nourish a strong love life with your wife. Turn to Proverbs 5 now. In Proverbs 5 and verse 15, look at what the writer of Proverbs has to say, this time to the married man. Proverbs chapter 5, beginning in verse 15. He says, drink water from your own cistern. I think that's the idea. If he's saying to a married man, you've got a well to drink from. Drink from it. Drink from your own well. Running water from your own well. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad? Streams of water in the streets? Let them only be your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. That word enraptured there means intoxicated. And what God is saying is, I gave her to you and it's okay for you to be literally intoxicated with her love. Now verse 20, for why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? Just always remember, when you try to say to God, now God, I couldn't do it. Sexual temptation was just too strong. Not as long as Joseph's there. You can't use that one. But then somebody says, but preacher, I've just done some terrible things in my life. I just can't sign up for the Christian race. It's amazing to me as a preacher how often I hear that. I can't tell you the number of times I've had people to talk to me and they just feel so unworthy and they feel like that they've just done such horrible things that they could just never come to God. Sometimes it's their past sins that beat them down. I had a man to call me one night that I had met and been talking to some, but he called me one night about 10 o'clock and he was upset. And he asked me if I'd come out to his house and talk to him. And I got out there to his house and we sat down for just a moment and he looked at me and he said, Jeff, he said, are you afraid to die? And I said, no. I said, no, I don't want to leave Susan. And I don't want to leave my little girl. I didn't have my boy at that time. I said, I don't want to leave my little girl. And then all the responsibilities that Susan would have to go through without me. But if you're just asking if I'm afraid to die, no, I'm not afraid to die. He said, oh, what I would give for that. He said, I lay down and I think about where I'm going to spend eternity and I, what I would give if I wasn't so afraid to die. I said, we can fix that. Obey the gospel. He said, no, I can't do that. And he said, you don't know my life. You don't know how bad I've been. You don't know all the things that I've done. I said, have you ever murdered anybody? He said, well, no, I've never done that. He said, well, I know. I said, I know somebody who murdered some people. He murdered a lot of Christians. His name was Saul of Tarsus, and he obeyed the gospel. I remember people on the day of Pentecost who had killed the very Son of God, and they obeyed the gospel. But you know, there's people out there who just feel like God could never forgive them. They've just done terrible things. But hang on a minute. Right over there, up there in the stands, I see David. And if you're a Christian, David is going to say to you, run on. Even as a Christian, run on. You're forgiven. In Romans, the 4th chapter, beginning in verse 6, speaking to the Christian and how that we need to trust in the forgiveness that we have in Christ Jesus, Romans chapter 4 and verse 6 says, "Just as David also describes the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works. David said, 'Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not impart iniquity.'" Here is David. Think a minute with me about David. David committed adultery. He wants Bathsheba. He calls for her to be brought to him. He has relations with her, and she becomes with child and sends word that I am with child. So he's guilty of committing adultery with one of his soldiers' wives, one of his mighty men, Uriah, a man who's out there every day fighting to protect David's neck. David brings Uriah home, and he's going to try to cover the whole thing up and tries to get Uriah to go home and be with his wife. I think that's so he could say, "Not my baby." You know, Uriah wants home, during some of that time. Not my baby. He even has to get Uriah drunk because Uriah is so loyal to David, he will not go home to be with his wife while the armies of Israel are fighting. And David has to get him drunk, trying to get him to go home. And he still won't go home, and he sleeps all night at his master's door. Somebody once said that a drunk Uriah was making better decisions than a sober David. And then he sends that man with a rolled up parchment and says, "Give this to Joab." And that poor man doesn't realize it, but he is carrying his own death note, because it says, "Put Uriah in the heat of the battle that he may die thereby." Heat of the battle, soldiers back off, and Uriah and others around him are killed. He's not only guilty of the murder of Uriah, he's guilty of the murder of other people as well. Somebody once pointed out that David, in one episode of his life, busted 6 of the 10 commandments. Number 10, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Number 7, thou shalt not commit adultery. Number 8, thou shalt not steal. He stole what didn't belong to him. Number 9, thou shalt not bear false witness. He's getting ready to lie about Uriah. Thou shalt not murder. And thou shalt honor thy parents. Honor thy father and mother. He didn't do that either. 6 of the 10 commandments in one episode, busted. But David's up there saying, "Blessed is the man who's forgiven." Remember, Nathan came to him and said, "Thou art the man." And David says, "I have sinned against the Lord." Gush of relief. And so David would say, "No, I did terrible things too. You can sign up for this race and you can run this race. There is forgiveness with God." I had a Christian one time. I later understood how she could feel this way because I found out what she had dealt with in her childhood. But she went into a severe state of depression, and I went and talked to her. And one of the things that she was struggling with was feeling bad and nasty and feeling as though she could not be forgiven. And I asked her this question. I said, "Do you believe the blood of Christ can forgive me of my sins?" She said, "Yes, I believe that." I said, "Do you believe that the blood of Christ can forgive the sins of all the people in the church building where we worship?" She said, "Yes, I believe that." I said, "Do you believe the blood of Christ is strong enough to forgive the sins of all the world?" She said, "Yes, I believe that." I said, "Well, if God can forgive my sins and the sins of all your brothers and sisters and the sins of everybody in the world, why can't His grace reach you?" Forgiveness keeps us running. And up there in the stands surrounding us are people who know that, and they are shouting us onward. And then there are those who say, "It's just too hard. I just can't do it. It's just too hard." But every time I think about something being hard, I see that man right there. I see Abraham. I don't know about you, but one of the most gut-wrenching things that I ever read in my Bible is Genesis 22. Turn there, please. Genesis 22. Abraham has waited a long time in his life. 90 years old when he has Isaac. And now, the child of promise has come his way, and oh, he loves this boy. And in Genesis 22, all of a sudden, the Bible says, it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham! And he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Man! He rises the next morning, saddles the donkey, travels with his servants, and comes to the place and says, stay here with the donkey and the lad, and I will go yonder and worship. Abraham takes the wood, lays it on his son Isaac, takes the fire and the knife. The two of them go together. And I'm thinking about a young man's voice who breaks the silence along the way and says, Father, we have the wood and we have the fire, but where's the lamb? Can you imagine what that does to the heart of this man? And he says, my son, God will provide for himself a lamb for the burnt offering. He goes to the top of that mountain. He builds that altar. I have thought those must have been the heaviest stones he ever picked up. And he builds that altar. He lays his son on the altar. He draws back his hand to bring the knife down. And the voice says, Abraham, Abraham, here I am. Do not lay a hand on the child. For now I know that you fear God and that you have not withheld your only son from me. The Christian life does bring some hard things. But Abraham is forever saying, come on. Come on. You can do it. Abraham's faith grew to the point where he was a man who could believe anything God said and do anything God said do without asking any questions. His faith and his trust in God was just that strong. And so I can't use that excuse. I'm not sure I know about hard. I'm not sure I fully know about hard like that. And if Abraham can obey God even when it's hard, I can obey God when it's hard. And then our last point tonight is, I hear the shouts of others pulling against me. I can't finish this thing. There's people pulling against me. Well, of course there is. I've never been to an athletic event where there wasn't an opposing crowd. There always is. And in our case, that opposing crowd is most vicious. It is the devil and his angels. Turn to Ephesians 6 and verse 12. In Ephesians 6 and verse 12, it says, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. My fight is not against just a man. But I fight against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against a spiritual host of wickedness in the heavenly places. There's the devil and all of his forces. There's people in the stands that are viciously against me. But you know who else I see, though? They're scattered all throughout the grandstands. There's a lot of people up there that I don't believe I know them. They are unknown supporters, but they're pulling for me, too. Go to Hebrews 11. You know, in Hebrews 11, we had all those people named that we know about, but there were some unnamed people that we don't know who they were. In Hebrews 11, now beginning in verse 35, it says, women received their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured. Whew, that's rough, isn't it? Tortured. Can't imagine some of these things. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trials of mockings and scourges, yes, of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. they were sawn in two, tempted, slain with the sword, wandering about in sheepskins and goatskins and destitute and afflicted and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Who are those people? I don't know. God knows. And they're up there in those stands, and they are pulling for me. That no matter what you face, no matter what you go through, no matter what persecution you have to deal with, fight through it all. Go. Win this race, because they did. They made it. And we cannot lose this race unless we quit running. I said the other night, you don't have to outrun anybody, just finish. And so there's unknown supporters. Will you just now with me now look up to the chief seat. Let's look high into the grandstands all the way up to the very top seat. Who do you see? I see Jesus. In Hebrews 12 and verse 2, it says, we look unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of God. He went through it all. The scourging, the mocking, the crucifixion. He pressed through it all. Verse 3 says, consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Consider him. Look to him. And then it says, you have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. Who ever faced greater opposition than Jesus? And I cannot promise you people that we might not have to spill blood on this track too. But I think the writer is saying, if you have to spill it, spill it. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. If you have to bleed fighting against sin, bleed. So you can't take this one and say, I hear the shouts of others. These did too. Jesus did too. But he finished his race. It is finished. No matter what our excuse might be, there's always somebody up there in the stands that could take it away from us. I could take a poll and say, what's some other excuses that you've heard for people not becoming Christians? I guarantee you we can find somebody up there in the stands that says that won't work because they overcame it. One more passage. Go to 1 Corinthians 9. In 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24 and 25, when we finish our race, there's a great thing that awaits us. Verse 24 says, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. In the New Testament days, a person would gut it out for a large part of his life to run his race and win his race and then get to run up the grandstands and to meet the king. And the king would place on his head a crown of laurel. You get to take that home and put it in a very prominent place and watch it fade and die. But we get to run up the grandstands. And the Lord will bestow upon us a crown of life that never fades, never dies, and is eternal. Don't forget those that surround us. This is one of those sermons that there's probably very few days that this sermon doesn't cross my mind. Just about everything that I go through and everything that I face, I can always think of somebody up there cheering me on and saying, come on, come on, run, run, finish. And you can too. The lesson is yours. If you need to respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ tonight, we sing a song to encourage you to come repenting, changing, confessing that you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and then being baptized in his blood to have all your sins washed away. If you need to respond tonight to the gospel of Jesus Christ, come while we stand and as we sing.